just go up there and hang out.
Like open the fridge and stuff, and there would always be foods laid out for us with little pre-wrapped sausages and things.
Mm.
They have pre-wrapped sausages, but they don't have pre-wrapped bacon.
Well, can you blame them?
Yeah.
If I had $1 million.
Okay, welcome to the second episode of Health on the Hill. This is the same four guys. This is Jamie, Chris, Gil, and Simon coming to you on CFER 88.7, 94.7 on cable, live streaming on CFER.ca. And in case you missed our first show last week, we are four Northern Medical Program students. And today's topic is the cost of healthcare in Canada. I'm sure that everyone out there listening has experience with the healthcare system and experience enough to wonder to themselves, who pays for this? How does this system run? And where does all the money go within this system? Now, a topic that's near and dear to all of our hearts in this room is the cost of medical school. And that's not just a selfish topic, because the public has a very large role in the cost of medical school, and that's something that we're going to talk about first. So, Gil, how much, what is your cost of medical school financially?
Well, the cost directly to me for tuition is around $15,000. And then there's simply the cost of not being able to work while I'm going to school. But that is by far less than what it actually costs. So the government does a lot of subsidizing for me and each and every student to be able to attend medical school. So I guess a question I have to throw out to the other three of you guys is, other than us paying tuition, what kind of costs are there, and where do those come from, whether it be in a family practice when we're shadowing, or perhaps third or fourth year? What kind of costs are there that make it such an expensive endeavor to go to medical school?
I guess there would be other financial costs that is somewhat of a burden to the public. I imagine that our tuitions that we pay are just a fraction of what's out there. Plus there's other untold costs, the time that the physicians take to train us, for instance. It might take away from some of the care of the public, but I believe in the long run it's probably worth it, because we do add more doctors.
Okay. Chris, what would you say is the average debt load for a medical student leaving medical school?
Given that all medical students generally have to do an undergrad before they start the medical program, there's generally some debt from that, somewhere on the order of, I know I'm floating around $40,000 from that. And then once you get into medical school, there's the additional costs from that each year. As for tuition, textbooks are a relatively large expense, some diagnostic equipment, and just things of that sort all add up quite quickly. And I think by the end of the 4 years,
I think it's around $156,000 is the average.
That's the average amount?
Yeah. So that's the cost directly to us. Then there's the cost that the community incurs. So physicians can't see as many patients when they're teaching students, simply because they have to stop and explain things to us. They have to take time off from seeing patients to come up and give lectures, and all of those sorts of things. Also, they're not necessarily a monetary cost. The provincial government actually saves money because the physician is seeing less patients, but it does cost the community where training is occurring.
I think you can think of more of of an investment, though. I mean, you are getting a lot back for the time taken and the money cost of it, right?
But I mean, that brings us to another issue of something called the brain drain, where physicians that have recently graduated from Canadian medical schools are immediately leaving to practice medicine in another country, which removes any of the benefit that you may get from training these new medical students.
That's an interesting point, Chris. So one thing I want to say about the brain drain, I guess, well, it's more of a question. Like, do we think it's appropriate? Do we consider our medical students as public property, because the public or the government is footing so much of the bill for the training of these doctors? Do these newly graduating doctors have a right to leave and train in another country?
Well, I mean, there's sort of the two sides of the argument to that. You're looking at one, the physician, I guess some people might say they have the right to practice wherever they want. On the other hand, because of our education being so heavily subsidized, someone could make the argument that there's something of a debt.
For example, in residency, when after people have finished medical school, they go on to residency, which is where they specialize. They learn to be a family practitioner, a family doctor, or a brain surgeon. If you graduate from outside of Canada and want to come back to do residency here, they require a return of service. So you get 4 years of education in your residency. You're required to deliver 4 years of medical service in an underserviced community. What do you think of that kind of organization or that requirement for medical students here in Canada?
I guess as far as an ethical question goes, most people would, you know, at first thought might think that would be a good idea. Other people might not. They might, I don't know, they might think it is an infringement on their rights, I guess. I don't know.
This rights issue always seems to come up. And I mean, obviously human rights are ever present in this situation, but when we say an underserviced community, as far as I know, we're not asking people to go and work in the most northern
Iqaluit,
or, you know, no offense to Iqaluit, but somewhere way isolated. I mean, Prince George counts as an underserved community, that size of town.
So I guess most people in the rural programs, which we are in anyways, we don't give them much thought, because the mindset generally is that we are going to stick around, whether it's in the north or in some other rural community within BC. Most people I have talked to are willing to put in their time anyways, right?
Yeah, but look at it the other side. If you're from Toronto or Vancouver and you don't get into a Canadian school, and then you go off to Ireland or to the Caribbean for your medical training, and then you're told you're going to have to move to Thompson, Manitoba, or even Prince George if you want to come back for training in Canada, a lot of people balk at that and say, no, I'm not going to do that. And they go to the United States for training, and then they don't even necessarily come back to Canada. And do we have a responsibility to not... I'm going on the other side. Do we have a responsibility to not require return of service?
Well, it's. I mean, as far as the out-of-country trained physicians, that's a totally different story. If we're denying them the opportunity to practice wherever they want after they've done a residency in Canada, it's different because they haven't actually gone through medical school here. But for those of us that are, I don't know, it's a different issue.
There are costs associated with being a resident too. It costs the government money to train residents as well. Maybe not as much per year for a medical student, but if you're going to have someone say come back from Ireland, because there's a lot of Canadians being trained in Ireland right now, if you're going to have someone come back, we've just saved a huge amount of money by not making them go through medical school. Why do we force them to go somewhere where they don't want to go if they're willing to stay in Canada at least? It's tough, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I guess another good example I have is and it's a good example, but it doesn't really relate to Canada, is in Iraq, after the U.S. invasion, a lot of doctors were leaving. The moment you graduated, you got your degree, you left the country because it was your ticket out. And they stopped giving out their degrees. They started saying, you are a trained doctor, and you will get your degree in 3 years once you've worked as a doctor here.
Yeah, I don't know. That for sure wouldn't fly
in Canada. No, it's an extreme example, but things have been tried elsewhere where it's a desperate situation.
I guess if the problem became so bad that a great percentage of our graduates were leaving, then restrictions like that might have to be put in place. But I think at this point, is it just another cost of healthcare?
Well, before we even talk about that, like, why is it even becoming a desperate situation? It's not like Canada is a bad place to live. So why are physicians so apt to go and practice in the U.S.?
I don't have any data on this. This is just me kind of making something up on the fly.
The answer is money.
But they're paid so much down there. So why why would you stay here if it's all about the money? Why would you stay in Canada for less money if you can go to a warmer place down south and make more money?
Well, the argument can always be made too, like, if a specialist in Canada can make $300,000 and in the US they can make $550,000, we're not talking about being above and below the poverty line. Those are both very healthy wages. So you can always make that argument as well.
Part of it probably is prestigious research areas within the States as well. There's probably limited resources as far as that goes within Canada, and more opportunity down south.
We're starting to get more here. In major centers like Edmonton and Calgary and Vancouver. But there's certainly a lot more research available, research dollars available in the U.S. So we kind of discussed that topic a fair amount, and I think it's time that we move on to a new topic. But before that, you're listening to Health on the Hill, CFIR 88.7 here in Prince George. If you'd like to contact us with comments, questions, or even suggestions for topics, you can email at us, hoth@unbc.ca.
All right. What is covered and what is not covered? We all go to the doctor, we go to the eye doctor, we go to physio. Does anybody really fully understand exactly how this healthcare system works? So first off, is physio covered, Chris?
No. Physiotherapy is not generally covered. Generally is the key. There are special circumstances.
So
what would those be, for example?
If you're injured in a car accident, ICBC covers you. Is that part of the public health system? Kind of. We have to get insurance to drive our car, and it's a public institution, but it's not part of the health system. If you're injured on work, that's WCB covers you. They pay for physio as well. Is that part of the health system? Not really, but kind of. What about if you're in the military or the RCMP? That's federal jurisdiction. They cover different things than the province of BC does. Different provinces also cover different things. It's really convoluted.
All right. What about the military? How does the military medicine work?
Well, as I was saying, that the military and the RCMP actually work for the federal government and are covered. Their healthcare is covered by the federal government. So when a military person or an RCMP person comes in to see the physician, they don't bill the province, they bill the federal government, and they use different forms and they have different rules and they get paid different amounts. And
okay, my head is spinning.
Yeah.
So what if Joe Bob patient just goes to see his family doctor? That's covered, correct?
Yes. If it's not for something that's not covered.
Such as?
Well, if they want a note because they missed work, or if they need an insurance physical, that's not covered.
I'm moderately confused. Is there any way that you can sum up the coverage in Canada?
It's messy.
Okay.
So generally, we're covered for most health issues that we might have, that any normal family might have. As far as other things, we can pay for extended benefits through work and be covered for other things, such as the dentist.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the phrase, sort of the tagline, is medically necessary hospital and physician visits or services.
That's the key.
That is key, actually.
And the medically.
For example, eye care, like a visit to an optometrist, is no longer covered by MSP. But if you have medically necessary, like a scratch cornea that you have to go to the optometrist for, that will be covered. Okay, so I think in summation, we talked a little bit about what's covered, what's not covered, and I'm personally as confused as I was before. Canada has socialized healthcare, and by that I mean it is a government-run program, and there are certain inefficiencies in any socialized organization. And there are obviously inefficiencies in our healthcare system. Anybody that's been on a wait list or been into the emergency room has seen some of these inefficiencies. So we're going to just talk about a few of them right here. First concept,
very topical. We talked about inefficiency in the healthcare system
is doctor shopping.
Wait list. Everyone's heard the term wait list. So
doctor shopping actually.
Why do we have wait lists? I mean, here in Prince George, even, why do we have wait lists for any kind of procedure, surgical, whatever?
Well, when it comes down to economic theory, there's something called queuing, and queuing is literally lining up in a queue. And if you're not requiring that people pay for something, if there is no monetary value placed on it, then there has to be another way of rationing the service that's available, since it is limited in how much it can be delivered. And in our case, that is waitlists. And whether it's good or not, it's something we have to deal with. Now, how does that introduce an inefficiency? Well, if you've got somebody on a waitlist for 2.5 years, and in those 2.5 years, they get a lot worse, and something that would have been a 1 hour procedure 2.5 years ago is now a full day procedure, that is a very big inefficiency.
Not to mention the medical costs incurred in that lag time between onset of illness to getting that procedure done, right?
Definitely.
Yeah, I heard a talk from a doctor about 2 weeks ago, and he referred to the Canadian healthcare system as we care for the sickest first, and then everyone else after that is equal. And I thought that was a good description of the Canadian healthcare system. But then, if that's true, why is it that when an NHL hockey player breaks his leg or something else, that he gets in right away for surgery, and you know, Mr. Average doesn't? How does that happen in Canada?
Part of it may have to do with their use of private healthcare facilities in the local city or even in a different city. What do you guys think about that?
I guess that there is some evidence that we do have a pseudo two-tier system in Canada in place right now. And I mean, that's a whole nother debate, whether is that right or wrong. Does it take some burden off the rest of the public to have the hockey player pay and go in to get the private health care, and then at least we don't have to worry about him in the public sector?
Yeah, I think it absolutely takes the burden off the system to have a private two-tier type of system. I mean, even here in Prince George, I mean, we have an enormous backlog on surgeries, and it's not enough to just say that if we hire X amount of surgeons, we could just
even more important
fix this backlog, because the problem is way more multifaceted than that. There's an issue of OR space. There's an issue of anesthetists and of OR nurses. It's not just that, you know, you hire a surgeon and he can just fill the backlog of surgeries in his backyard. You have to work within the system, and it's that system that is causing this backlog.
Yeah, there are shortages at all levels. Staff-wise and actually facility-wise, and you can't just throw doctors at it to try and fix it. You need to actually work with the entire support staff.
Another example there is of inefficiency within the system is the amount of times that our healthcare system is reorganized. If you look at Alberta, in the last 10 years, they've reorganized their management system 3 times. They had one large organization that took care of healthcare throughout the province. And they decided that wasn't an efficient way of delivering service. You could tailor delivery in certain regions better by having small health regions that made local decisions based on local realities. And after a few years of doing this and the cost incurred of reorganizing, they decided it would probably be more efficient to have less local administration centers and have larger regions, kind of like we have here in British Columbia. And so then they reorganized to that, and that cost them a lot of money, but they were better able to, they could still have the efficiencies of large areas that were managed by one set of people while doing more localized decision making that could be tailored to certain regions. But again, there was a trade-off there. So recently, within the last year and a half, they've decided that they needed to go to a more efficient way of delivering healthcare. So they went to one large super board for the entire province. And again, at a cost of millions and millions and millions of dollars, they reorganized again. And that's been done 3 times in the last 10 years. So that's really inefficient to do that. But can it be avoided? It happens all the time.
I guess do you look at the end result, or is Alberta's healthcare system that much better than BC's at this point? I don't know. Have you heard any reports from any patients?
Well, they've got a lot more money,
I suppose.
But how much of that is because of the oil?
That's right, but are they that much healthier to, you know, for it?
So that's life in a socialist healthcare regime. There's no easy answers, and we could go round and round on the inefficiencies of our healthcare system.
So we talked a lot about inefficiencies in the healthcare system, and we've talked about the cost of education and why people are leaving Canada and a whole lot of things like that. But what do you guys see as solutions to the cost of healthcare? Because we're spending over 10% of our gross domestic product every year on healthcare.
Gil, what's with all this positive thinking?
I don't know. I guess I'm just an optimist.
All right. No, in all seriousness, I mean, there are definite solutions out there, and I'm not taking any credit for this at all, believe me, but I have heard that one idea that's catching on in family practice is group visits. So if you have, you know, 5, 10, 15 patients with a similar condition and one that's not confidential, such as possibly pregnancy or diabetes and things like that, that you can combine those visits and you can basically give kind of a group visit to everybody, and everybody shares in the treatment, and, you know, one question that one person has, everyone hears it and everyone gets it answered. And that's proving to be quite effective in family practice. So that's one way.
But on the other side of that, I mean, you could approach with the idea that people aren't getting the individualized care that they would get seeing a doctor or seeing a physician one-on-one. And I mean, seeing the group approach, you may get a generalized solution, but specific issues aren't going to be addressed like they would be otherwise.
Certainly, it doesn't take the place of one-on-one doctor relationship, doctor-patient relationship. It's strictly an additional concept for those visits, where it is just purely to disseminate information about a very common disease that many other patients in your practice have.
So definitely wouldn't be for all aspects of medicine, just a few.
Yeah, it's only, again, as I said, it's only for non-confidential, common, chronic conditions. And I'm not saying that pregnancy is a chronic condition, but pregnancy was one of them.
So how does it save money?
Well, instead of a family doctor having the same discussion with 10 different patients about how to use a blood glucose meter, or that's a bad example, but I mean something to do with diabetes or something to do with pregnancy, then you could have a 1-hour time slot where you have 10 patients with the same affliction or same condition, and you can say it one time. So it would effectively save you 9 visits.
So really, you spend 1 hour with these 10 people, and you can go over a lot of material in that 1 hour, something that would take multiple visits for multiple people, in the time that a physician can only really see at most 6 people.
Yeah. So I guess the question is, would you guys be comfortable doing that, either as a physician or as a patient?
As a physician, I probably would. As a patient, I might think twice about it. That's just a personal...
I think it's something that has to be patient-oriented, so you offer it to the patient as an option. They can think about it. It may sound weird at first, but a lot of what we hear from patients or from people who've taught patients in this method say that they arrive there kind of unsure, but then they meet others with similar experiences to them, or even who have progressed in the disease state further, and that inspires them to change unhealthy habits to prevent that progression.
I mean, at the same time, yeah, you're creating support networks. If the patients are comfortable with that, with those who have experienced the same thing or will be experiencing the same things, and that's definitely an advantage to that.
Can you guys think of other examples of way of reducing the cost of care, maybe to do with electronic or the internet, maybe with medical records and sharing between physicians? What about if you have multiple physicians working in one office who take care of, say you have 5 physicians taking care of 10,000 patients, and they can be seen at any time of the day, instead of one physician working with 2,000 patients? Is that a cheaper way of ensuring quick access to care for people?
I don't know if it would be cheaper, but it might result in less wait times, having more physicians available to a given number of patients.
Yeah, it would definitely, I think patient satisfaction would go up. I mean, I know it'd be a lot easier if I could go and see my doctor in the evening. I mean, just because I'm busy in the day. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer. But yeah, is that what you're getting at?
Well, I know of an example. When I was in high school here in Prince George, the dentist I went to would, every second week, they would be in their office doing dental work from something like 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. for 6 days in a row. And then Sunday they were off. And then the following week, another set of dentists and assistants would come in and use that same office space. And so they were better. They were able to deliver the dentistry to just as many people over half as much time and share the cost of renting their real estate and buying their equipment between two sets of people.
Yeah, I think actually my dentist did the same thing, and we probably went to the same dentist.
Fabulous. But,
I recognize your smile. But anyway, so I guess, is there a chance, like, okay, why don't family doctors do that then? Because to the best of my knowledge, they don't do that. Is there a reason that you can think of why they wouldn't work those type of hours?
I don't know.
Okay. If anyone knows, feel free to throw us an email at hoth@umbc.ca. Okay, another thing that can promote, or that is more efficient, sorry, for the system is electronic medical records. Gil, what are electronic medical records?
Essentially, instead of charting the information, the medical information on each patient visit on a piece of paper and then storing it in a cabinet somewhere, you keep the records on a computer. And then you can bring up those records when you're away from your office, say you're in the hospital, and the patient has come in with perhaps a related problem to their chronic condition. You can bring up those records immediately, make decisions based on the notes you've taken previously, and you can make decisions faster, you can make better decisions. There's also other things, like you can take the x-rays that have been taken they have this here in Prince George. When you take an x-ray, or when you have an x-ray taken of your foot, maybe it's broken, maybe it's not, and you go in, or they take the picture, they look at it, it's put onto the computer system, then you go back to your family physician the following week, and you've been told your foot isn't broken. But the radiologist has gone in, taken a second look, and said, oh wait, there's a small fracture right there. Maybe it's something that they should know about. So you come in complaining about foot pain, the doctor goes to their computer, pulls up the x-ray, sees that the radiologist has changed their diagnosis, has noticed something very small, and then your family doctor can say, actually, your foot is a little bit broken, and this is what we should do. And then you didn't have to go back in and get another x-ray.
Okay. So from the time that we've all spent in doctor's offices here, how would you say the adoption of electronic medical records is going? Does everyone use it?
From what I've seen, I've only visited a very low number of physicians' offices in Prince George, but they seem to all be using the electronic medical records. And I know the same goes for practices in Terrace as well. Yeah. Many of the doctors, if not all of them, take advantage of the electronic medical records over the paper system.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it comes down to personal preference, but I think it is going that direction. Now, along with everything in medicine, it's a major political issue as well. And I know that Prince George uses a separate EMR system than the rest of the province, I believe. And that is an issue in and of itself. But it does appear that EMR is the future. And
EMR meaning electronic medical record?
Yeah, okay. Easy for you to say.
Yeah.
It does appear to be the future. Whether or not it's actually more efficient, I couldn't say for sure. But I guess stay tuned.
So that pretty much brings us to the end of this week's show. We hope you guys enjoyed this. If you guys have any other comments you'd like to make or questions about the show, please send us an email, hoth@unbc.ca. This is Health on the Hill from CFIR 88.7 right here in Prince George. Thank you for listening.
I'd buy you John Merrick's remains,
ooh, all them crazy elephant bones.
And if I had $1 million,
I'd buy your surgery.